The lessons over the last two or three Sundays have stirred a lot of interest and have called out a lot of response. The vast majority of what I've heard has been pro, but I'm sure there's been some negative response also. But that's all right, too. Many have come and talked. Many have made good suggestions. Many have gotten involved in the subjects and the issues that are at stake. And I want to commend you for your thinking. I would like to offer some further substantiation, some documentation. For those of you who were shocked and perhaps disbelieving the allegation that the present female workforce is providing an unlimited opportunity for immorality at the hands of dishonorable bosses and management and employers, you might look at the November 1977 issue of Ms. magazine. If you would like to get a copy of that, the whole issue is on what is described here as sexual harassment on the job and how to stop it. And this entire issue deals with the subject of how that secretaries especially, and others who are thrown in close proximity with unscrupulous employers, are being approached and harassed sexually, and their jobs are at stake. So you might want to get a copy of the November issue of Ms. and read that. It's written by women's liberation advocates, and they're aware of the problem. For those of you who would like some corroboration or documentation regarding the detrimental effects of hard rock music, and obviously all rock music is not evil, and at the same time, a lot of country western music is getting about as filthy as the rock music and its lyrics. But there's a booklet here put out by the Campus Journal. We have about 30 copies of this left, but if enough people want it, we'll run them off, we'll Xerox them for you. And this will document, and was written by a young man who used to be in the rock music scene heavy, and you'll be glad to read this. It'll open your mind, I think, to some things. About $1,000 worth of rock records have been destroyed this past week. That wasn't my idea, but someone picked up on it and have done that. One boy brought about $400 worth of broken records and put them in my office, and he was thankful that he'd been liberated, he said, from that power. And I know this brings negative reactions. Some of you just fume and stew, but I've made a decision. I'm not going to let you leave here having listened to me as many times as you have to listen to me. I'm not going to let you go away without having at least been warned. Now, Jesus wanted to do something for Peter once, and Peter didn't understand. Jesus said, "Peter, you don't understand right now, but you'll understand later. And I'm counting on that when you get out, and it may be just simply when you have children of your own and began to see how detrimental certain aspects of this rock scene are on your own children, then I guarantee you, you'll understand what I'm talking about. But that's available if you want it. For those of you who would like to have two real fine articles on against pornography and the detrimental effect that it has upon both young and old, if you'd like to write in, there are two articles, one, A Parent's Case Against Pornography, and then an article written by a doctor, Pornography is Not the Harmless Recreation It Is Said to Be. If you'd like those are available too. Now, those of you who would like either one or both of these, take a card out of the rack in front of you, put your name and address, and on the back of it, put either porno literature or rock literature. And we'll see that it's mailed to you, and we'll get this information to you so that you can talk intelligently about it and reason intelligently about it. You know, there are times when I would like to say, shoot, I just won't say anything more about anything that's adverse. Ezekiel... Or was it Jeremiah? It was Jeremiah that had the same tempting thought. He liked to be liked, but he couldn't hold back on things that were absolutely essential, and so I can't either. I'm not running in a popularity contest. If I were, I wouldn't be preaching the gospel of Christ. I'd do something else. Those of you who are searching for the Lord, leave your mind open and let's keep searching for what's right and for what's good. In the book of Ephesians chapter 5, Paul says, try to determine what the will of the Lord is. Now, this was in this whole section of what to do about evil. Have nothing to do with it, expose it. Right in the middle of it is this little jewel that says, try to determine what the will of the Lord is. And you know, that's a pretty good measuring stick. If we can decide what the will of the Lord is, we'll be all right. Now, all of this brings to us, our minds, the question, is it necessary to be so narrow? And we'll have to admit that holding on to the standards that Jesus gave us for our lifestyle is, to many people, too narrow. They would rather not go that route, limiting ourselves to the straight way that Jesus talked about is just simply too narrow for some people. And so we come to this question, is it necessary to be so narrow? The term narrow has such a bad connotation, especially today. People, you know, they can't say anything worse about you many times than to say you're so narrow. And in today's world, you know what the philosophy is that is holding forth today and that has the minds of most people captivated? The philosophy today is unlimited license. Do your thing regardless. If it feels good, do it. Now, that's what is the philosophy of the world today. And that's why those who are Christians who are trying to hold to the standards of Jesus Christ, that's why you're pointed at as being narrow-minded. And many times they'll call you a narrow-minded bigot. And you can't get much nastier than to call somebody a narrow-minded bigot. But I want to urge you to look at it. Look at it very seriously. You know, narrow is in harmony with nature. Now, if you're wanting to do what's natural, if you're wanting to get back to nature, you're going to have to get back to what's narrow. And the cry today is, get back to nature. Well, if those who are crying, get back to nature, will follow nature's example, nature will lead them back into a narrow view, a narrow approach to life. Now, let me give you some illustrations. Nature itself is narrow. Do you remember, and you can kick about it all you want to, you may object to it, but it won't do any good. It's just there. It doesn't stand up and shout. It just simply is there, and you either conform to it or you get kicked out. I remember going to Pearl Harbor some years ago and going aboard a monument there that is erected above the ship Arizona. The monument is in commemoration of over 1,000 men who lost their lives in the bombing of Pearl Harbor. They lost their lives when the ship, the Arizona, upon which they were residing, sank, having been bombed, and these men were encased in this ship and were literally buried, all 1,000 plus of them, I think about 1,200 of them. These men died, I think, for one reason. They died for lack of oxygen. And that's all. They just couldn't breathe. The air finally was depleted of its oxygen. Well, you say, that's terribly narrow, isn't it? Yes, it is. You mean to tell me that the human frame, the human body, cannot live without oxygen? It sure can't. And it will die. The brain, I think, dies in about 3 minutes if it's deprived. It's hopelessly. Is that right? 3 minutes is about the extent of it without it doing damage. Well, that's terribly narrow. One of our own Searcy residents this past week and his son were camping out in a camper hunting. The flame on the heater in the camper went out, and gas filled the little camper where they were. He died because he was deprived of oxygen and his brain was filled with this noxious gas. Terribly narrow, nature is. During the war, a B-17 bomber called Lady Be Good was returning from a bombing mission over Europe, came back to its Mediterranean base, but was brought along by such a strong tailwind that they thought they could not possibly have come to their base location at that point. And they concluded that some German force had erected a false homing device and that their instruments were calling or being called by that false German device. They ignored the call, went straight on down over the Mediterranean, went out into the desert, ran out of gasoline, landed the plane intact. They all survived the landing. The radio was still good when it was found some 20 years later. There were men sitting there with writing pad and pencil. They were all in good health. The plane was in good condition, except the men had died from lack of water. You can't live without water, and that's narrow. You can't live without oxygen. You can't live without water. You've got to have them both. Nature is narrow. You know, you can't jump off of a 20-story building. It's narrow. Nature won't allow you to, or you might like to. It gives a nice feeling for the head. It kind of makes you, you know, swimmy feeling, and it's really exhilarating. But your legs can't stand it. And that's awfully narrow. You mean we're limited to one plane? Well, virtually. Now, you might parachute off, but that's something else. And we've learned to fly. And that's getting us out of one plane existence. We're learning to fly, but go to Houston and talk to some of the astronauts and see how long and how strenuously they prepared and studied just to make sure that they conformed to nature's narrow limits. See how often and how long and to what degree they prepared to make sure that when they went into outer space, they did everything just right, because they know that there's not that much marginal difference in nature. It won't allow you to tamper with it. It's narrow. And you can just go on and on and on and give example after example. But not only is nature narrow, the incidentals of life that keep us in line, that's narrow too. If you don't believe it, pass on a place in the highway where there's a yellow line beside the center line. And you let an officer of the law see you do that. Go ahead and try it. He'll stop you and he'll give you a ticket. Why? And you might say, well, officer, there wasn't a car coming. That doesn't make any difference. The law says you don't pass when that line is beside the center line in your lane. Well, that's terribly narrow, officer. Yeah. Go ahead and tell him how narrow it is. And then you can go on to the judge, and then you can tell the judge how narrow it is. And then you can write a check and then pay the fine, because that's exactly what's going to happen to you. It's narrow. You know, you're going to be taking tests before long. And there are some narrow-minded teachers on campus. There are a million wrong answers that you can give to a question. But there's virtually just one right answer. Now, you may have a question that can be debated both sides, and there may be two answers that will satisfy, but virtually there's a right answer and a million and more wrong answers. Because, you see, everything about us is narrow. Truth is narrow. Everything that we see around us is narrow. Christ also described his way of life as being narrow. He said, "Enter in by the straight gate, for broad is the way that leads to destruction. Many there are that enter in thereat. But straight is the gate, and narrow is the way that leads to life, and few there be that find it." Narrow, straight, and few. You say, "Lord, that's awfully narrow." That's true. Jesus said himself, incidentally, that "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And we're going to be singing this song in just a few moments. I am the way, singular. The truth, singular. The life, singular. No one comes to the Father but by me. That's terribly narrow. Someone says, "Well, what if I don't want to go to God through Jesus Christ?" That's too bad. There were some people in a parable that Jesus taught in Luke, the 19th chapter, where they sent out an ambassage and said, "We don't want this man ruling over us." Well, Jesus didn't say, "Well, that's all right then. For those of you who don't want me ruling over you, then you go find someone else." No. When he returned after having received the kingdom and came back for the reckoning, he reckoned with the person that had been given the talents, the five and the two and the one. And then he said, incidentally, "Call those people that did not want me ruling over them and slay them before me." But that's terribly narrow, isn't it? It is. And it's not enough just to accept Jesus Christ in name only. He said, "Not everyone that says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that does the will of my Father who is in heaven." Narrow. Well, you can go on and on, you see, and drive home the point that everything that we are really called upon to do, if you're going to be in the right, you're going to have to be in the narrow way. Now, you don't have to be any more narrow than Jesus is narrow. That's sufficiently narrow. And you don't want to be narrow just for the sake of being narrow. But you want to be Christian and let Him determine what's narrow and what's broad. Well, you say, do you have any standard then of obedience in the Bible? Is there any way that we can determine what God wants and to what limits He calls us in our obedience to Him? Yes, there is. In the book of Romans, Paul says that the things that were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. The things that were written prior to this, the Old Testament writings, he says, were written for our learning, that we through patience or steadfastness and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 10. There's a more lengthy statement of it there. First Corinthians 10 and verses 6 through 11. Now, these things are warnings for us. Look at verse 5, rather. Let's look. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. He's talking about the history of the Jews. Now, these things are warnings for us, not to desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written. The people sat down to eat and drank, and rose up to dance. We must not indulge in immorality as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put the Lord to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now listen to this. Now these things happened to them as a warning, but they were written down for our instruction upon whom the end of the ages has come. It happened to them as a warning, and it was actually transcribed. It was written down for our benefit upon whom the end of the ages have come. And that observation there in 1 Corinthians 10, 6 through 11 is very appropriate to our age today, because we seem to have some tremendous aversion to authority. Our generation seems to despise authority, and we devise 101 ways to erect and resurrect some circumstantial evidences, some extenuating circumstances, some things that would cause us to be able to rationalize our way out of disobeying or out of obeying God and into disobedience. And so we find that the whole Old Testament is given as an example of how we ought to live before God in obedience and how we ought to shun disobedience. Now this morning I want to give you three examples, outstanding examples of disobedience. Tonight I want to notice about three or four examples with you of obedience. Obedience in the face of the foolishness of God. But this morning, let's look at these three examples of disobedience. They're all pertinent to us. We could have chosen one out of 1,000 or 10 out of 1,000 if we had chosen. But I've chosen just three. They're very simple. I want you to remember them. Number one was the example of Adam and Eve. Now, you've heard a lot about Adam and Eve, and you ought to hear a lot about it. What was characteristic of these people? Well, the one thing that was characteristic about Adam and Eve and their sin was they sinned against God by disobeying a direct commandment. No question asked, they just simply disobeyed a direct command. And no amount of rationalizing excused them. Now, they rationalized themselves, tried to rationalize themselves out of it, but it didn't work. Someone said, well, maybe they didn't understand. Oh, no, they understood. Eve quoted what God said twice. God said it to her, don't eat of this, because in the day that you eat of it, you'll die. And then Eve quoted that again to the serpent, and a second time she quoted it. No, she didn't misunderstand. She just simply did what she wanted to do. You know how she rationalized herself into it? She said later on, as she was accused by God of having disobeyed, she said, well, the devil made me do it. She said, this serpent beguiled me and I ate. I wonder how many of us have ever rationalized ourselves in the same way, or rationalized ourselves into doing something that we really wanted to do by saying, well, the devil made me do it. And that's been made popular by a popular present-day comedian, the devil made me do it. But he got it from you and me. He didn't invent it. And you and I didn't invent it. It's the temptation that we have to rationalize ourselves into sin. You know how Adam rationalized himself and excused himself from having done it? He said, everybody else is doing it. Everybody else was doing it. Now, he said, the woman that you gave me, she gave me the fruit and I ate it. But what he was saying was true. Everybody else was doing it. There wasn't but one other person on earth at that time, and that was Eve, his wife. And she ate it, and Adam said, well, everybody else was doing it, so I did too. Now, this hits every teenager right square between the eyes. It hits every adult between the eyes, because we all were teenagers at one time or other. And how many times have I told my mother and daddy, well, everybody else is doing it, as though that would make it right. I remember what an old Greek teacher of mine once said. He said, it's always right to do right, and it's always wrong to do wrong. No matter how many people are doing wrong, that never makes it right. And no matter how few people are doing right, that never makes it wrong. Because it's always right to do right, and it's always wrong to do wrong. Well, that's the first sin, a sin against a direct commandment of God. And no amount of rationalizing it as far as the devil made you do it or as far as everybody else is doing it just doesn't make any difference. They were still wrong. But a second example of disobedience, and that is Lot's wife. Lot's wife sinned also against the command of God, but she sinned under tremendous emotional pressure. God had told them as they left the city of Sodom, he said, get out of here, I'm going to destroy it. And he said, when you leave, don't look back. And so Lot and Ms. Lot and the two daughters fled, but Mrs. Lot turned around and looked back. I wonder why. Well, she was a woman, maybe curiosity got her, I don't know. But I suspect that it was more than just curiosity. Her friends were there. Her sons-in-law to be were there. Her house was there. Her belongings, the things that she had made perhaps with her own hands, they were all there. And you might just simply say that this woman sinned under tremendous emotional pressure. Could she not have pled with the Lord this temporary insanity that we plead so often today? Lord, it was temporary insanity. That's why I did this. That won't hold water. In the book of Luke, chapter 17 and verse 32, Jesus appeals to Lot's wife as an example. He said, remember Lot's wife. Remember Lot's wife. Why did he say that? He said it as a warning against loving the things of the world. Because in the next verse, verse 33, he said, he that loves his life shall lose it. But he that loses his life for my sake shall find it. He was talking about being emotionally attached to the things of the world. That's why Lot's wife looked back, he said. She was looking back, trying to cling to the things of the world. She didn't want to lose the things of the world. I wonder how many of us are doing the same thing. I wonder how many of us are going contrary to what John said in his first letter when he said, don't love the world, nor the things of the world. For all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life, are not of the Father, but are of the world. And he says, if anyone does love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And then he says also that he that does love the world, he'll be destroyed with the things of the world, but he that loves God, he'll live forever. This was the problem here with Lot's wife. And he says, you remember Lot's wife. She sinned under emotional pressure, but the emotions were simply those emotions that are present when a person clings to and loves the things of this world. I heard recently about a man whose house burned down. And he rushed back into that burning house, you know what for? To get a pair of shoes. And he burned to death. To get a pair of shoes, yeah. I read about another man who rushed back into his burning house frantically looking for something to save, and he brought out a potted plant. Well, that doesn't make sense. No, it doesn't. But neither does what we try to cling to make sense either at the expense of our own lives. Jesus said, "For what will a man exchange? What will he give in exchange for his soul? If you try to save your life, you're going to lose it." When he wrote to the Colossians, Paul said, "If you've been raised with Christ," and he's talking to those people who have been buried with Christ and raised with him to the new life. He says, "If you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Put your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth." Do you want to get emotionally involved in some things? Do you want to really be torn emotionally to where you don't know whether you're coming or going? Let me tell you how. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6. And verses 9 and 10. Here's the way to become an emotional schizophrenic. You're split, you're divided. "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and hurtful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced their hearts with many pangs." I stopped at a service station day before yesterday and got some gasoline. And the man that was riding with me said, "I used to know the man who founded this whole oil company." He said he was a Christian. But he said as the money began to pour in, the man lost his faith, turned away from God, and went after this thing of money. Now, money is not evil, but the love of money will kill you, to destroy you. Jesus said, you remember Lot's wife. Don't be involved in running back into the house to get something, to save. Don't be involved with any emotional entanglements with things in the world, because he said, it's going to perish. It's all going to be destroyed. Well, then finally, there's a third example. Adam and Eve is an example. Lot's wife is an example. And then here's a third example, and you're going to say, oh boy. This example is the Israelites. And I want you to turn, if you have your Bibles, if you'd like to turn back to Numbers, the 11th chapter. Numbers, the 11th chapter, the first six verses, is a record of the grumbling of the children of Israel. This is referred to, one of these instances is referred to in the 1 Corinthians letter, chapter 10, that we referred to a moment ago. These people, it says in verse 1 of Numbers 11, "And the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes." And then verse 4 says, "Now the rabble that was among them," that is, those who were of baser instinct, those who had come along as stragglers out of Egypt, "had a strong craving. And the people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had some meat to eat. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt for nothing. And the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. Y'all remember all that we used to eat? But now our strength is dried up and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at." You know what they were doing? They sinned against God because they grumbled about what they had to eat. They were taking offense at the menu, the desert menu that Moses was providing. He was in charge of that cafeteria. And they came through that line every day, 7 days a week, 3 times a day. And they looked over in that thing and thought, good grief. Again? Then they'd poke each other. Do you remember when we were back home? Oh, you remember the fish we had to eat and the garlic and those watermelons and the cantaloupes and the leeks? And God destroyed them for that. And in 1 Corinthians 10, he says, let me tell you something. Don't grumble. Don't grumble. Now, do I have to make the application, or how many of you get the application? Do you understand what I'm saying? You see, this is a frame of mind. I asked Brother Merritt the other day, Brother Merritt, how are you doing? He said, I'm not grumbling. And I thought, boy, that's it. I'm not grumbling, because we are prone to grumble. If it's too hot, we grumble and wish it were cold. If it's too dry, we grumble and wish it were wet. If it were too wet, we were grumbling and wish it were dry. If it's too hot, we wish it were cold. And you see, we're really never satisfied. These people weren't satisfied when they were in Egypt. They weren't satisfied when they were away from Egypt. They weren't satisfied when they had stuff to eat. They weren't satisfied when they didn't have what they had before to eat. Larry Archer, call emergency White County Hospital, please. Larry Archer. So we find these three sins. These people sinned, Adam and Eve, against a direct command of God. Lot's wife sinned under emotional pressure. The Israelites complained about their menu. Now you say, boy, that's getting it pretty narrow. And yet that's exactly what God intends for it to be. He wants you to be the kind of people that are thankful. There are two mountains over in Israel today. They've been there ever since the earth was created, I guess. One is north of the other. Both of them are north of Jerusalem. One is the Mount Ebal, which is north of the two, and then Mount Gerizim. God likes object lessons, and he liked to give these people object lessons. So as they came into the land of Canaan, he named these two mountains. He said, I want you to name Mount Ebal the mountain of cursing. I want you to name Mount Gerizim the mountain of blessing. You can drive along the highway from Nazareth to Jerusalem and come along both of these mountains there at the foot of them. See both of them. And he erected both of those mountains and says, this is to be a remembrance. I want you to remember this so that every time the Jews looked at those two mountains, they would remember the law of God and the curses that he placed upon as he placed upon them if they disobeyed him. And then the blessings that he placed upon them if they obeyed him. And if you want to turn to Deuteronomy later on today and read Deuteronomy 27 and 28, those two chapters, and here it describes the blessings and the cursings. And these two mountains are given as a show and tell demonstration by God. And he showed them the two mountains, and he told them what was going to happen if they obeyed him and what would happen if they disobeyed him. And today, you and I also need some examples of obedience and disobedience. And so the whole Old Testament, in a sense, is erected as these two huge mountains. Because if you'll go back into the Old Testament, there's a whole mountain of examples of people who obeyed God, and we'll notice some of those tonight. And this whole mountain of examples of people that disobeyed God. And there's a curse placed upon all those who disobeyed him, and a blessing placed upon all those who obeyed him. So, do we have anything to go by today? Yes, we do. Is it necessary to be so narrow? Well, if you're going to use the Old Testament as an example, yes. If you're going to use nature as an example, yes. If you're going to use the incidentals of life as an example, yes. If you're going to use the statements of Jesus about his way, yes. And so we come to this conclusion. We're going to have to make up our minds to be a narrow people, a peculiar people, not strange, but set apart to do the will of God. And only those who have that spirit leading them are really and truly God's people. We're going to sing this song, I Am the Way, the Truth, and the Life is what it's taken from. And we urge you to make your decision this morning. Do some serious thinking. Decide right now to either follow Jesus Christ or not follow him. But if you decide to follow him, let him call the shots, won't you? And pattern your life after his life. We're going to urge you as we stand and sing, come if you have any need whatsoever, come while we stand and sing.